Hello, listeners. Welcome back to Food Fault Lines. We had an extended winter break here to focus on some awesome projects that we're going to kick off today's episode with. First and foremost, FeedSpot ranked Food Fault Lines as a top 50 food and beverage podcast, which proves you never know who is listening. Our first project that we released is called Food Shifters, where each person who signs up receives a monthly email with an on-demand cooking demo that explores culture and food with our home cooks, because just like this podcast, we want to help listeners explore new cultures through food and offering that support through home cooking guided by other home cooks. And our first session was actually led by our content creative guru, Krishna, and she makes a dish that grounds her into her roots from West India. And for today's episode, we wanted to bring in that startup energy, excitement, and adaptation that just happens naturally. So we have culinary creative Tamika Francis on the stage, who is the founder of Food and Folklore, and she's going to tell us a little bit more about her organization and what she's also currently building, which is called Dutch Pot, a space for creative culinaries to build community and collaborate. Let's get into it, because her love and respect for food is something you have to hear. Hello, everyone. I'm so excited to welcome to our kitchen table this afternoon Tamika Francis, who I had the pleasure of meeting pre-pandemic times at a powerful dinner that she organized. And I'm going to let her introduce herself. Tamika, can you tell us where you're located at the moment?
Sure. I am currently in the Hudson Valley area of New York, just during this pandemic period right now.
And when we met, you were actually the founder of Food and Folklore. So I'd love if you can tell us a little bit about that and where that journey has taken you the last 2 years and where you're at now as a food entrepreneur.
Sure. So Food and Folklore, I started around in 2018. Initially, it started very informally as just brunch amongst friends and conversation, and just having conversation with various folks in the culinary space who, like myself, are either newer to the U.S. or second generation or first generation, but just they had like a very interesting food story. I like to say we have hyphenated foods. I've been talking to those folks, and they just couldn't find their place in the current culinary world, you know, to show their full selves. And we've been talking about how do we elevate those underrepresented stories? How do we showcase, you know, the food stories that we know from our history and our heritage? And that kind of morphed into Food and Folklore, which was really about story-based and storytelling in the food scene in Boston primarily, but now in New England. And so that went on for several years. We did a series of pop-up dinners, in-person culinary classes that are story-based. And then when the pandemic hit, we kind of rolled back to mostly online classes right now and conversations, but hoping to, in the next few months, really revamp our pop-up dinners, working with a cadre of various chefs throughout New England.
I think what I was most excited about bringing you on for today's episode is that our brands are in very similar ecosystems where using story-based food experiences to elevate the story of an individual, of their community, of their ecosystem. And I'd love to know, when did you immigrate to the States?
I moved to the U.S. In 2005, May 5th, 2005. I remember it because it was the day after my mom's birthday, which was also Mother's Day. And I didn't think it through. And she was quite, you know, she was less than happy.
That's definitely taking a big leap on a day with many, many holidays. And what are maybe two food traditions that you brought with you that you still practice each day, especially being a mother?
Let me see. So I'm the mother of an American-born child, and I'm Jamaican, Caribbean. I'm very global in my experiences. So I don't think there's any particular food. I think it's the way we eat. Breakfast has always been a hearty meal, right? So breakfast for us growing up in the Caribbean, going to school early mornings, had to be a hot meal, usually paired with a hot beverage like tea or, you know, Ovaltine or Milo or some kind of malt or chocolate based drink. So I make sure I find myself, at least with my son, ensuring that we never miss breakfast. We don't skip breakfast. We have a sit down. Even if we're running a little bit late, you know, I recognize that breakfast for us is our first meal of the day, and it's a very good start to the day.
It's so interesting you say that, because in the United States, there's always that large breakfast is the most important meal of the day. And I wanted to understand, where does that actually come from? So after doing some research, it ties back to the 90s with Kellogg's. It was just simple marketing and, you know, TV marketing that just launched that campaign. So it's really interesting where, quote unquote, breakfast is the most important meal of the day. It was just to promote cereal. It had nothing to do with healthy foods, real foods. And what's so interesting, me coming from the Dominican Republic, very similar, where breakfast is hearty. Like, it can be plantains. Someone's going to have their coffee, their chocolate milk, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting, because I think breakfast is one of the hardest niches to break into when you're bringing other cultures to highlight and share with others.
Yeah, and you're correct. It was part of the Kellogg's marketing and grains and cereals. But I do know, I remember my dad is saying about, you eat like a king for breakfast and a prince, I think, for lunch and a pauper for dinner, kind of thinking through how our bodies, you know, function on fuel. So I try and hold that dear to me. But when I travel, you are correct. I have a hearty meal for breakfast overseas, and here it tends to be a sweet baked good or a grab and go sandwich, which doesn't resonate with me. I do it sometimes, especially in the corporate world, but I do like a sit down hearty meal. To be honest, I'm having an omelet right before we called in. It's an omelet with chicken and sauteed kale, topped with cheese, and then I have yuca, fried yuca or cassava or manioc as my side with a cup of tea. So I am definitely a hearty breakfast person, a heavy protein, a solid, you know, grain or tuber or carbohydrate of some sort, and definitely a vegetable.
Full disclosure for anyone listening, you will be leaving this conversation hungry, because that breakfast sounds absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, it's delicious.
So great to hear that the pop-up events are going to be reemerging. What else is going on for Tamika as a food entrepreneur? Tell me a little bit about Dutch Pot and that newest project.
Oh my God, yes, thank you. So yes, our culinary pop series will be emerging in some format. I'm talking with the folks over at the Jerk Fest, the Jerk Festival, to collaborate with She Chef in particular in March. We're still working through the details, and we're likely going to be doing pop-up through delivery or pickup services with a virtual component, making sure we offer folks a full experience. So that's still in the works. Our things in the pipeline, still working with various, you know, private clients to do culinary classes. I'm still available for that. We're also working with a few youth programs, which I absolutely love doing. And also my mainstay or main consistent culinary class of Curio Spices out of Cambridge. But during all this teaching and online and conversation, we've also been building what's called Dutch Pot. So Dutch Pot is intended to be a global online community and management tools for culinary creators like myself and like you, who are somewhere in between a restaurant chef and a home cook. So we're not quite restaurant chefs who have a brick and mortar space. And we're not just home cooks. We're folks who really want to share our food stories, our products, our conversations, our food, either through small catering, private in-home services, classes, pop-up styling. And so I'm creating this space alongside my colleagues for culinary creatives to gather, have conversation, collaborate on projects, and have a portfolio together at dutchpot.app.
And now, sort of being behind the scenes and creating an app, what have been some of the greatest, like, aha moments that you're having as a learner?
Yeah.
Because in school, we did not grow up taking, how do I build an app?
Yeah. So it's intended to be an app. It's not an app. It's web-based for now. Still in the very, like, beta stages. You know, I came into this tech solution or this tech world through an amazing fellowship, Visible Hands out of Boston, that funded founders who wanted to launch a product, right? And so through a 14-week product program with Visible Hands, I really had a chance to hone in on a problem. And for me, that problem is going to be in the food space. It's going to be in the culinary creative space, and really kind of think through, how do I solve this problem, given my experience, given my talent, given my connections, my network, and how do I collectively kind of think through how to add value to this space? So for me, kudos and shout out to Visible Hands for the partnership, for the funding, and really for the lessons, the connections, the conversations with other folks who are newer to the tech space, but folks who are really seasoned, series of workshops and conversations and an in-person week-long orientation with another 25 or so fellows across the country who are also in a similar space.
What was a parting thought for someone who had their first experience in the VC world, especially being virtual?
I had an amazing experience. I had a remarkable experience. I think Visible Hands, we were their first cohort. It was very thoughtfully produced, very thoughtfully curated, both virtual sessions and in-person component. We were met where we were. So there are some folks who were at the ideation stage. Others had already launched. And while we're in the same cohort, I felt like they really paid attention to where each founder was, not just the product or what they were building, but where they were in their journey. So I came away with a really good experience. I know VC world is very controversial sometimes, but I think given their ethos, given their mission of really supporting BIPOC folks and first-time founders and founders who are not well connected, I definitely had an amazing experience. I've left with 25 other founders who are just friends and allies, but also my LinkedIn connections have gone up in terms of folks who are both available as sounding boards and resources and potential advisors. So I'm really, really impressed by the program.
And then I think that's what is magical about this new era of organizations that are where people meets profit. The sustainability component is so much more at the front end of it, because it's not that we want to be a one-off or being the first cohort, the first group, the first woman, the first Black, Latinx person to do this with a product. It's about really creating an ecosystem. And you do that being a resource magnet, whether it's from a social media platform of LinkedIn, where in one click you can easily connect with someone. So I love that importance in really building a community. And of course, like, organizations were always going to be in a different spot. Some organizations are shipping the kid off to college while other organizations are learning how to put on a diaper the right way.
Yeah, I think we're in, we're at the edge of a new world, right? Things are evolving, the world is evolving, the way we work, the way we converse, the way we eat, the way products are built. So I'm both excited, anxious a little bit, because I think some folks are being left behind while others are being supported. So we're at this very interesting intersection of the world shedding its old pre-pandemic ways and evolving into a new, I think, new identity. So excitement on the horizon. I think there's space for a lot more folks to succeed and to find their way in this new world.
Absolutely. And especially us in the food sector, really leveraging this gig economy that we're in.
Absolutely. So that's a space. I mean, I do have a full-time profession outside of food. And so for me, the culinary space is a gig, or has been a gig for me for many years. And I see my peers, I see my other colleagues who are amazingly talented, and many of them are looking for resources, tools, systems, supports, network. They have talent, right? They have stories, they have connections, they have what they need to succeed. They're really looking for back end support. So through Dutch Pot, I'm hoping to build that application. And I think the gig economy will continue to grow. And so having tools to be successful will be increasingly important.
Yeah, I mean, even in 2020, two in three people reported some form of freelance work. And that number is only going to continue to climb.
Yeah. I mean, I've been a serial entrepreneur, so I'm excited that more folks are seeing entrepreneurship, putting a product and putting yourself out into the world, right? How amazing it is to have an idea, to conceptualize and ideate about something and then create it and solve a problem for the community and for folks more than yourself. That's pretty amazing, I think.
And it's also exciting.
Yeah.
Because you learn that there are so many mind-built boundaries that you're just able to push through, to jump over. And in reality, sometimes you reach a dead end and you're like, okay, but I still have an aha. I still have so many takeaways that I gained from this because it's just another chapter in the story. It's this or something better.
I mean, in another podcast, I'd love to talk about all my failed ventures, right? I have been a serial entrepreneur since I was a teenager, and I do think it's through, I like to fail fast and fail forward. I do know sometimes it's hard to fail in public, right? To have a venture, an idea, not to be sure if it will work out. But there's so many lessons you learn, the confidence, the grit, the resilience of, again, having an idea and being audacious enough to put it out into the world.
And I did not know that you started your entrepreneur journey even as a teenager. For me, my entrepreneur journey as a teenager was selling gum at school. Like, I would buy packs of gum and just upsell them. What was your first entrepreneurial idea that you put out?
Let me see. So I started, my first job technically was selling ice cream at my dad and my uncle's ice cream store. I worked at the flea market with my aunt, my in-laws at the time. It was there I started to hustle, right? So my in-laws, my aunt-in-law, she would import lots of goods from overseas to Jamaica. And I recognized that my high school, my Catholic high school, there were people who just wanted these goods. So I would get them as gifts, or I, you know, buy them at a low cost and then resell them. But I think I really turned the corner when I started to sell my dad's farm produce. So we had an abundance of mangoes and oranges and bananas and all this produce from my grandparents' farm on the weekends or holidays. And I would sell that in my classroom. That evolved into selling the products of my home economics class. So I made food for home economics. And if I had food left over, I had my colleagues who'd either pay for that food or they'd have to wash my dishes or help me clean up for the food. So that used to be fun.
What an operation.
Oh, it was, I'm sure Miss Francis, my homework teacher, and sister Marie Stephanie, I mean, God bless her heart. I hope they don't hear me. But yeah, in high school, I was selling my home economics food.
That's amazing. And it's so funny that you also had an option for people to wash your dishes, because as a food educator now with kids, we love cooking. We love that process. And then sometimes there are kids that are extremely enthusiastic to wash dishes, and other times not so much.
Right.
What's something else I can do? I'm like, got to do the whole process, got to wash the dishes. So I love that you made that a currency.
Yep, absolutely. You should pay in cash or kind.
And for someone who has now been a mom for some time now, and I see how much of a value you place on food creation and just food education with your son, how have those gears sort of shifted from educating masses versus just one-on-one in my own home?
You know, the interesting shift for me around food education since I've had my son, it happened right. So in February 2020, I had the honor and privilege of making meat pies for Tony Tipton Martin's book launch jubilee in Boston, alongside El Simone Scott. And there was from She Chef, and there was also folks from Comfort Kitchen, Kwasi. Just an amazing talent of folks in Boston, organized through Melissa, who's from La Conexión. Just amazing, again, food entrepreneurs, culinary creatives. And I was introduced through Tony Tipton Martin's book to African-American food ways in a way that I didn't have access to before. The pandemic happened in March. We're home. I have this amazing cookbook. I think, you know, again, it was a moment of racial reckoning for many who had not paid attention to America's history before. For me, it wasn't. I work in racial equity work in my daytime. But what it allowed me to do was recognize that I have a Black son, right? And even though I am Jamaican, living in America, Caribbean, I want him to understand African-American food waste because he is Black American, right? And so we started working through that cookbook. I started reading about the rice in the South, right? The Lowcountry and the Gullah Geechee people who I'd been familiar with, but really taking a deep dive. I spent some time making like crayfish soup and bisque and a roux. So food, I think methodologies that I'd never paid attention before were now available to me through this cookbook, and I had time and we were home together. So I got him a step stool and we started making food together, and we've been working our way. I've since gifted that book to other moms of Black sons or Black kids, because I think it's a great way for them to learn about their food ways of this country and how well connected and how rich it is.
And I love that there was just a focus throughout the whole cookbook in cooking, because sometimes what I've seen, it's more common for kids to bake because you're using less utensils, it can be easier, you're putting things in the oven, whereas it can be just as, if not more, enriching to cook a meal, to, as easy as you mentioned it, bottom a step stool.
Yeah. Yeah, we did both. So we cooked through another baby toddler cookbook. But I think you're right. People do stay away from complicated processes with kids. And just like the way you consume an elephant, you know, bite by bite. So, you know, pieces by pieces. I build on the skills. He is only 2.5. So I'm talking about the stirring. He works well with tongs and chopping, you know, here and there, breaking things with his hands. So I am doing the bulk of the work, but I think I'm educating myself more than anything else. I can definitely be a resource and a guide for him in terms of his food stories. So grits wasn't part of my own experience, and now I'm making grits, right? Because that will be part of his experience here in the U.S.
And it's really powerful when you have that moment that history is really anchoring down on the food you're eating, on the food you're creating in your own kitchen, because it is part of his story and now in weaving into yours.
Yeah.
And I love that.
Yeah, we've been having fun. We've been having fun.
And food is just, it's a basic need. And as is that fun component as well, because as much as it sustains us, it honors us at the same time.
Definitely. I mean, I like to say I've never met someone and not strike up a conversation about food that doesn't allow us to connect in a very human and basic way, right? There's going to be something somewhere that says, oh, yeah, me too. There's always a moment of, oh, I see you. I am similar. We're not that different. Whether it's in family traditions around food, holiday traditions, the way we prepare a meal, the way we eat a meal, there's always potential for connection through food and conversation.
I could not echo that more. People ask about the weather. I try to learn about something and their food relationship or experience.
Yeah. And you know, the central question for our pop-up through the Chose Diaspora series that Food and Folklore hosted was, what does home taste like, right? And that question wasn't just like tangibly what does home taste like. It was really to understand another human experience. It may be a memory, it may be an actual taste, a smell, a sound of sizzling. So it was really to have our guests at the time connect in a meaningful way that wasn't about asking what school you went to or where you worked. Those are, I guess, essential questions in some spaces. But for us, our dinners, you know, understanding people's food stories was a real way to connect and become friends and become connections immediately.
And to wrap us up, what does home taste like for you?
Oh my gosh, I've never been asked that question before. Even though I ask, home taste for me, you know what? Goat always comes up first, or curry. Not necessarily curry goat, but curry was an essential part of my Jamaican food experience. It was a rich experience. I mean, curry chicken, curry goat. But I also remember, like, the pan, most times a Dutch pot, right, that the curry was made in the night before. If you sautéed or if you scrambled an egg the next day, then the egg had that curry color and a little bit of that taste. So somehow it's like a memory that's so simple but just brings joy to me. So for me, home tastes like resilience. My mom always tried to offer us a little bit of everything. So I have distinct associations with days of the week and what food we have. And Friday night was a treat night for us. So home for me tastes like joy. It tastes like curry. It tastes like resilience. Resilience, family traditions.
Thank you for sharing how food is your own dialect and it continues to evolve as a parent, as an entrepreneur, as a member of a larger food community, whether that's New England and beyond. Mm-hmm. And I'm just honored that you were able to share that with all of us. And I'm excited to see the journey evolve with Dutch Pot. And we're definitely going to be bringing you back on, because that episode of you talking about all your entrepreneur failures is just gold, gold.
lessons learned, right?
Any parting thought that you have before we wrap up our episode?
I mean, for your audience, I think a great way to connect with another human that you don't know, I think is through their food story. It may appear a little random if that's not your thing, but you'd be amazed how much you hear, how much you understand from another human being through what we collectively enjoy, which is food. So thank you, Kiana, for the space and for all the work that you've done. It's been a joy to just see your own journey as you evolve into being a culinary creative yourself.
Thanks
for having me.
Yes, of course. Thank you so much.
There you have it. Tamika's love and respect for food pours out in her words. I had the honor and privilege to attend multiple of her food and folklore dinners before the pandemic. And the community that's naturally born from a place of curiosity with the food in front of us, it's powerful. It's a value that we both share and that the Isle Mind team brings into our mission, into our podcast every single week. And we are thrilled to be back and look forward to amplifying these stories, home cooks, and all of the fun projects that we have ahead.